The new maritime strategy for the Army, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard relies on four key tenets that shape how the service will face future challenges. Brian McGrath, U.S. Navy retired, is managing director of the Ferry Bridge Group and assistant director of the Hudson Center for American Sea Power, and he was a primary author of the 2007 Maritime Strategy. He writes, along with Brian Clark of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, that those four ideas will not only cause debate among strategy purists in the defense community, but they will also cement the legacy of the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Jonathan Greener. Brian, thanks very much for coming on the program. It's great to talk to you today. What is the difference between the 2007 strategy that you were involved with constructing and the document titled A Cooperative Strategy for 21st Century Sea Power, Forward, Engaged, Ready? Thanks for being on today, Brian.
My pleasure. I think the primary difference is that the 2007 strategy dealt with a very different world, a world in which a week or so before the strategy came out, the Dow Jones Industrial hit its highest point ever at that time. We had not gone through the fiscal crisis. China had begun to make some noise, but not quite the noise that it's been making in the years since. So that document was aimed at sort of a grander strategic level. I believe this document is appropriately aimed at a more military strategy level, a little bit harder edged, clear-eyed about threats and what the Navy will do to face them.
You write, along with Brian, that this new document, like its predecessor, will likely be criticized by purists for not adequately balancing ends, ways, and means, and for its lack of clear priorities. Do you think those criticisms are reasonable and rational, Brian?
They're reasonable and rational, and they're wholly predictable. I mean, it's, the world is full of strategists, or people who think they're strategists, or who want to define strategy, but there are only very few people who actually sit down and write it. They are almost always judged against the standard, especially in military strategy, of balancing ends, ways, and means. And that's very difficult to do. It's incredibly difficult to do in a service, or in this case, an element of military power level strategy, because you don't have control of all of the levers. You don't have control of the budgetary levers. The Congress and the President work together to determine how much money the Navy's going to get. The Navy doesn't determine that. Yes, it's rational and reasonable, because that's the way you measure strategies. Ultimately, though, it's not useful, because they can't possibly meet that standard.
You write in this about the all-domain access strategy shift. What's the significance of that, as we understand it, compared to the document that you wrote in 07, Brian?
Well, it raises, when it says all domain, we like to think of the land domain, the air domain, the surface domain, the subsurface domain. But now there's the electromagnetic domain included in that, cyber. And it's the sense that the Navy is raising this concept of gaining and maintaining access throughout all of the domains. It's raising that to a level co-equal with, say, sea control, or co-equal with, say, power projection, as something that the Navy, or that American sea power, more broadly understood, provides for the joint force. It raises the importance of those concepts.
You and Brian write in this piece that there is a lack of discussion in this about a robust naval and maritime industrial base. Why is that troubling to you? And is a strategy document like this the place to have that discussion, Brian?
I think it's the most appropriate place. This is the maintenance of an industrial base that could support sufficient surge in wartime is inefficient. It doesn't blend well with our concept of free markets and efficiency and those sorts of things. But you need it. You need to be able. I mean, we had all sorts of industry that we were able to turn into shipbuilding and tank building and plane building and the like for World War II. Those industries are gone forever. And in order, because ships take a long time to build and fleets take a decade or decades to build, you have to be ready all the time, especially with sea power, because it's a capital-intensive service. And you have to have some surge and some excess capacity, especially in munitions, the building of precision weapons and bombs. You have to have some excess capacity for when and if conflict does start, you're able to ramp up to a production level. We are at a peacetime production mentality, and that's fine as long as you never plan to fight anybody.
You mentioned China a few moments ago, and one thing that was not present when you worked on the document in 2007 was the rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region that is in effect now. And you write about the challenges of A2AD, anti-access area denial, in this document. What impact does that have, do you believe, on the 2014 edition of this strategy? And does it have the right emphasis on A2AD and the implications for the United States trying to be prepared to fight in that part of the world?
This is a yes and no answer. Yes, it has an appropriate level of emphasis on A2AD, wielded primarily by China, Russia, Iran, but in this case, particular to the Western Pacific by China, as a tactic or an operational concept on their part to deny us the thing that we need most in order to do our business, which is access. If you can't get there, our massive army and our wonderful Air Force can't be of any use because we're thousands of miles away. The problem with the way this strategy talks about it is that A2AD is treated sort of as in a vacuum. It isn't treated in the larger geopolitical sense of great power dynamics, of something that China and Russia will do in order to solidify their role, their rise, their place in a world in which great power competition has returned. We're dealing with the symptom, but not the sickness.
The concept of great power competition and great power dynamics is one that, admittedly, I think some folks, maybe not in the Pentagon, but some folks in the strategy and foreign policy community haven't entirely wrapped their arms around yet all the way, though, Brian.
Well, I don't think it would be a surprise to anybody that people in the Pentagon think about the world decades from now, what it could look like. And the trends would suggest that great power dynamics are back in vogue and that we have to begin to think again about how we as a nation are going to act and what our strategies are going to be in that world. And I think this was an opportunity to sort of nudge the system, to push the system a little bit. The strategy in 2007 nudged the system, and it nudged the system in no small part towards a greater emphasis on the Pacific. These documents are useful to nudge the larger system, and I think they missed an opportunity on that. And one of the few missed opportunities. It's a good document all in all.
I did notice in this document there is a discussion, but not a huge emphasis, it doesn't seem, on the size of the fleet of the United States Navy. And you point out, you and Brian point out in this piece on War on the Rocks, that there is an overwhelmingly Navy orientation, as you refer to it, in this piece. What do you make of the discussion lately about the size of the Navy? Because it seems to me, at least, that a lot of the discussions revolving around the number and not as much around the capability of the ships that are in the fleet.
Well, I think that that's a very widespread view of the situation. Oh, you guys are talking about numbers, you don't talk about capability. The bottom line is that in peacetime, when navies do two big things, they help to regulate the peacetime security environment. They do that by being forward, present, and powerful in numbers, because you can only be one place at a time. The fact that a ship can fire precision-guided weapons or we have these wonderful combat networks matters in that peacetime regulatory environment, but it doesn't matter as much as ships being there. Um, the the weapons and the networks matter more in the other thing that navies do, and that is to support land armies when they fight ashore. And that's something I think that capability matters at least as much as numbers. But in the first instance, that peacetime presence, security-regulating environment, numbers matter, and they continue to matter, and that's why people like me talk about numbers all the time.
Brian, you and Brian Wright, to wrap this piece up in War on the Rocks, this new strategy is an important step forward and a coherent recognition that the world's changed in significant ways since 2007. If supplemented by statements or discussions that make its priorities clear and by the national will to implement those priorities, it could lead to a significant and beneficial strengthening of this foundational element of our national power. What would you like to see in terms of those statements that you're proposing, statements and discussions, and what has to change in the national will, if anything, to be able to implement these priorities?
Well, we write about it in the piece. For instance, is that when they talk about the force levels that are required in the Mediterranean, you would come to the conclusion that what was driving that more than anything was Iranian missile defense by, you know, putting Navy ballistic missile defense destroyers in the Mediterranean in order to counter that threat. There's no discussion of the Russian threat in the Mediterranean. The Russians routinely have more ships in the Mediterranean than we do these days, most of the time. We abandoned the Mediterranean after the largely as a theater for combat power after the fall of the Berlin Wall. I would like to see, and this is where you tie ends, ways, and means. If I believe that this great power competition that we are moving back towards again, if the Navy is going to play the role that it traditionally played in this role, it has to be present and powerful, and that means a return to the Mediterranean. In order to do that, it has to be a bigger Navy, because we don't have the force structure to be in the Mediterranean, in the Indian Ocean, and in the Western Pacific.